Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Raw here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we are in your ears thanks to the magnificent OldFootballShirts.com. Well, the international break is over and we can now get back to league action. It's taken us 4 months to play 11 games so far this season, but we now face 11 games in just 44 days as we head into the busy Christmas period. Today, we travel to Aston Villa for what will be the boss's, Graham Potter's, 100th game in charge of the Albion. And in the opposite dugout will be new Villa boss Steve Gerrard, and the Villains will be hoping for a new manager bounce after losing the last five. Fortunately, we like teams who let it bounce. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we are delighted to welcome to the show an Albion hero. I joined the club in 1980. He went on to make 37 appearances in a four-year spell that was beset by injury and suspension. However, despite only playing a small number of games, this man will always be remembered for his time here, most notably his appearance in the 1983 FA Cup final. He also went on to be the first black manager of an England team, taking charge of the under-20s, and he's now currently the technical director at QPR. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the show, Chris Ramsey.
Hi, Chris. How are you going, mate?
Hi. Very good, thanks. Very good. Thanks for inviting me.
That, Chris. It's actually Chris Ramsey MBE now, isn't it?
Yeah, fortunately, yeah. Yeah, it is.
Let's just get his name right, absolutely. No, listen, Chris, fantastic. We've tried to get you on the show before. Absolutely brilliant to see you there. Admittedly, we're doing this with Zoom and you've got a QPR top on. You're forgiven. Obviously, it's your employer, no problem. But no, we want to have a natter with you about your Albion time. And there'll be people who are of a given vintage who want to hear about your time at the Albion. So yeah, welcome to the Albion Raw.
Thank you very much. Honour to be invited.
So Chris, I mean, we're gonna take a trip through your career here and elsewhere, but let's go back to the beginning. You were born in Birmingham, back in an age where we're not going to give away your age because we know you're still 21 at heart and you still look it. And you know,
he does look in good nick. I mean, for all those on who can't see this on Zoom, I've got to say, Chris Ramsey, he's older than me and he looks well. A lot younger than me, so you know he looks in good nick, folks.
Thank you very much.
He really does. So talk us through. I mean, you were born in Birmingham, and you're growing up there, and the journey between there and playing football there in Birmingham to becoming an apprentice at Bristol City.
Born in Birmingham, lived in London, grew up in an Arsenal territory, Arsenal supporter, played for the school team, obviously. I went to Charlton on trial as a kid. Well, Arsenal first, got released from Charlton, ended up at Bristol City as an apprentice, got released from there. And fortunately for me, I went to Brighton and had a four and a half, five-year spell there, which was absolutely fantastic. And that's how I ended up there, really, from Bristol City after being released.
So how long were you at Arsenal Charlton? I mean, enough to have actually earned your Spurs, but...
No. I was a schoolboy at both of those clubs, but didn't manage to get an apprenticeship, it was in those days.
Yeah.
I was fortunate to get one at Bristol City. It was brilliant, Bristol City. In those days, they had some greats there. Terry Cooper, Norman Hunter, Joe Royal, people like that were there, you know.
It kind of makes it sound like a sort of an England 1970 World Cup graveyard, because I think they've been promoted to the top division about two or three years beforehand, hadn't they?
They did, and they held their own for a while, but obviously the bigger clubs overran them towards the end. But no, it was a great time there, and I met some absolute heroes, you know, that in those days would be like going somewhere with... you know, the current England players that are playing now. Mm.
So what do you reckon you learned from those particular, sort of guys that admittedly at the tag end of their career, but what were the first things that, as an apprentice, you learned from them?
Well, obviously, when you're dealing with people like the old, you know, Terry Cooper and Norman Hunter, who played in the old Leeds team that were at the top for a good decade or so. So professionalism, And to be honest with you, I was in awe of them because, like we spoke about before, there wasn't the internet there. So to see someone who's actually been on telly in those days was, you know, like seeing a ghost. You wouldn't actually ever meet your heroes, you know, as intimately as we meet them now.
So how did it go for you at Bristol City? How far into the apprenticeship did you get?
I got to the end and then got the boots.
You make it sound so like such a hard luck story. I guess it's probably, I mean, as someone who's in the position of football that they are now, you probably get to realise that it's probably, I'd imagine, just as hard as a director or a manager to say to a kid, sorry, got to let you go. But, you know, you remember that as a 16-year-old. As to someone who is doing their job now, I say technical director at QPR, it's you've seen it on both sides, and I'm just going to put it to you. I mean, I imagine it's hard, just as hard to say this kind of thing as it is to hear it.
It's very difficult because obviously when you're involved, I mean, I'm involved in the academy, and obviously I'll be with the first team this evening. You know what it feels like, so you do have a you know, some empathy for the kids that are getting told no. But it is the worst part of the year, the worst time of the year when you know that you're coming to retain and release. Mm. You have some sleepless nights because obviously you have to make some very harsh decisions that can change lives. You know, I don't like that. That's very, very much the worst part of the job.
But I mean, it's a very, very small percentage of players that do actually make it through that. And even then, there's no guarantee they're going to go on to have a successful career. I mean, I would like to point out to everyone to Kieran Maguire's excellent Price of Football podcast, where he's actually just done a brilliant interview with Maheta Malango, who's currently the new PFA chief. And he's very big on how you educate these players that you're not necessarily going to make it, about how what small percentage of players actually do go on to it. I mean, out of it's 1%, I think it is.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the current figures, it's 0.012% out of 1.5 million. So it's absolutely, it's almost nobody makes it really. And trying to educate the parents is what we try and do here. And try to get the boys to value themselves as people, not just as footballers, because we know that the likelihood of them making it is so small that they need to think about other things in their life. And a lot of times parents live their lives through their children, which is probably the most dangerous thing.
Okay. So given that, you know, that things are probably done differently now, and what you're talking about at QPR sounds like something that's not dissimilar to what happens at Brighton. You have the education for the, like you say, for the kids in question, but for the parents themselves, who are also, you know, they set their heart on that. You know, they probably couldn't be a prouder parent for that kiddie who makes it to the first team, makes their debut and so on. So, but when you had this and Bristol City said thanks, but no thanks, what kind of systems, what kind of structures were in place to support you and your colleagues at the time?
Not really. There wasn't one really. I mean, to be honest with you, that's when they actually, round about then, they started sending kids to college to do a course which was more vocation, which I agreed with at the time. We never used to go, to be honest with you. but it was in place. It was in place. But the thing was, is in those days, they would call you in on your birthday or just around your birthday. Right. and tell you when you got to 18. They would tell you the week of your birthday that, you know, whether you were going to be kept or not. But there was nothing in place, really. You got released and then you had to find your way. There was no agents. And to get a trial somewhere, you had to write by hand. To get a trial, and then you'd often get a letter back. The actual manager used to read the trial letters. So I was very fortunate at Albion because Ken Craggs, God rest his soul, he picked up my letter and brought it to Alan. He actually told me that they'd thrown away quite a few of the trial letters that week, and he'd actually had to go to retrieve it from being thrown away. And he brought it to Alan, and Alan brought me in on trial.
So what was it about your letter that stood out, do you reckon?
I think what happened was I was in the England under 20 squad when I was at Bristol City, despite getting released, I'd gone and I was in the squad there, and Gary Stevens was in the squad as well. So I think Alan asked him, and Ken has asked him, did he know me? And at that time, they, you know, it was different in those days. You actually replaced player for player. So if you've only got one fullback, you're actually replacing that fullback. Now you've got a squad system. So they gave me a trial, and fortunately for me, you know, I did well on the trial, and you know, there were people like George Aitken and people like that there who helped me in the reserves to play well and get to the next level.
Well, given that both Bristol City and Brighton by this time were first division clubs, albeit Bristol City were about to go down.
Yeah.
What was it that happened at Brighton? Is it luck that what happened at Brighton that didn't happen at Bristol City?
No, there was quite a bit of support there. John Shepherd, who was, you know, one of the scouts there at the time, you know, he helped me to settle in. I was in digs with his daughter, Linda, and they treated me as one of the family. So in those days, that's what you needed, that really, because there was no external stimuluses, you know, like the kids have got now. So that was important to be put in a family environment at that time, and I think that helped me to settle down at the club.
I mean, also, I mean, you came. It was a brilliant interview you did with the Albion website, and there was some stories you told about your time at Charlton, about not wanting to get on the train or standing on the bridge over the platform in case there was skinheads and stuff on the platform.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, how was it coming to Brighton after having that experience? Because I mean, Brighton traditionally isn't. It's a very cosmopolitan place, but there wasn't too many black faces around at that time.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't very cosmopolitan then. However, it wasn't. I didn't witness any sort of street violence in the same way that you do in London. Hmm. It was a very genteel sort of place, especially the ground being in Hove. You know, it was a very genteel sort of place at the time. There wasn't a lot of diversity there in those days.
It isn't now, mate.
It was in Hove.
No. Yeah. All racism, mate, is actually just behind the twitching curtains.
Well, that's what happens. And the fact is, when you're probably one of the only diverse people in an area, you probably don't experience it overtly.
Yeah.
As you might do if there's more people.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, so tell us about, given the person you became later after you left football, well, I want to touch on sort of the social issues later. But let's come back to the Albion. Tell us about the Brighton and Hove Albion from 1980 that you walked into. The people, the characters, did you feel, were you made to feel welcome? Tell us about your first experiences there.
No, listen, when I went there, you know, you got people like Steve Foster, who's still my great mate now. I saw him a couple of weeks ago, you know, and I had people there like, you know, Tony Grealish, Jimmy Case, Perry Digweed, lots of friends that were there. And to be honest with you, I got on with everyone there. The club had some great players, you know, when you think about the amount of internationals we had for such a small club. It was just a great place to play. In fact, it was probably too nice a place to be. Well, it's a very nice place to be where people, you know, sometimes when you're in rougher environments, there's a different level of fight, shall I say. I mean, and I'm not saying that the players didn't fight for what the club. It was just one of those places where everybody wanted to come to. And we had some players that would come to the latter end of their career to play there. But, you know, obviously Brighton's a small place, and when you're dealing with the Giants, as we can see, even now, they would be in a similar sort of situation to we were in those days, where you're trying to attract quality, which we did, but you still can't compete with the teams that are at the top of the league. So, you know, it's one of those places now, if you're a top player, you know, you want to go and live in a place like Brighton, you know, the way it is, how cosmopolitan it's become, the beauty of the place, and obviously it's near the sea.
Well, there is that, because if you're talking about sort of players who are going to fight for the team, I'm sure that you'd rather play alongside Foster, Grealish and Case than against them, I'm guessing.
Well, I think that's why the club managed to stay up for the period that it did do. Because if you look at people that would put their foot in, there were a few people that would put their foot in those days. And the camaraderie, I don't think, you know, can be matched. You know, obviously the culture in the 80s, there was a lot more alcohol about in the 80s, and some of the nights out that we had, and the camaraderie, you know, were legendary. So you can't beat those memories. I know now that there's a lot more money involved, but I think the camaraderie was you know, couldn't be beaten.
Can you remember the places you used to go to, Chris?
I don't want to incriminate anybody who's still here.
Well, to be fair,
if you can remember it, you weren't there.
The players that we've had on from the 80s, I think the most recent one was probably Danny Wilson, who I think was a little bit after Chris anyway.
He came in my last year.
Oh, okay, got you. He actually tells a similar story to you, Chris, about how it was Steve Foster who welcomed him and sort of stuck his arm around him. It's as if there was a kind of a different Steve Foster to the one we saw this sort of like man mountain, big beard, headband, and all those things that we consider to him this, you know, and even when he returned in his mid-30s, at the fag end of his career, he's still someone that's bright through and through, even though he played for other clubs. But it's kind of interesting hearing from so many different sources, including yourself, about this kind of, for want of a better term, big brother that Steve Foster was in his playing days.
And you know what? There's no captains like that now anymore. You know, he came in, you know, captain of the club, captain, if you had a problem, you'd go to him. I mean, I used to stay around his house sometimes on the night before games, and we've travelled together, we've been on holiday together. And when you come in and you see someone of that stature, and he was a very good performer, very really less than a 7 out of 10 in how he played. So he led on the pitch as well as leading off the pitch. And you know, I think he was the cornerstone of the club at that time, an unofficial manager, really.
Yeah, I mean, and he was when he came back, the way he stood up to the board that actually had sold the grounds and was treating Brighton with contempt, you know, the second time rounds. And, you know, he often cites his favourite Goldstone moment was David Bellotti being chased out of the West Stand, you know, and this is a bloke who played 354 times for the Albion. Of all memories you're going to have is that. And you can tell, the bloke's Brighton through and through. But let's get back to you, Chris. Like I say, as AD said at the top of the show, 37 appearances over 4 years is not a testimony to your talent. It is down to the fact that, for the most part, you're injured. Plus the little tidbit that we picked up earlier today that we didn't realise. your fun and games you have as a referee. But let's start with when you did play. Tell us about your debut. Do you remember it?
I remember it. It was against Crystal Palace, and you know, testament to Alan Mullery. I mean, you think about it now. You're going to put an 18-year-old in when you need to win the last four games. In defence, there's not many people that would have done that. So he showed a lot of faith in me, Alan. There, and obviously, I was playing against the great Vince Allaire, who was. You know, there was no sort of manual to deal with someone with his talent. So obviously, I had to resort to the defensive attributes that I had at the time. The clever art, shall I say? I had to resort to that, and we won the game, which you know led us to get on the way to staying up.
No, well, Chris, obviously we have to talk about it. Can you just remind us, because I mean, obviously it was Crystal Palace, can you just remind us what the score was that day?
3-0.
Yes, it was. And that does exist on YouTube. And
does it?
I mean, I think it was Gordon Smith scored twice. And was it John Gregory got the other?
John Gregory, I think John Gregory, yeah.
Yeah, and but Gordon Smith, what a player.
Outstanding player. I mean, when you think he played so well in both countries, he's played for some good teams, and he was smooth player, could play in this era, you know, as a 10 all day long, you know. But like I said, it was testament to the quality of the players that we had there, you know, like Neil McNabb, you know, the late Mick Robinson, who was one of our great mates as well. You know, there were some very, very good players at that club in those days.
Gordon Smith is the only person, apart from anyone who's maybe bald or thinning hair, Gordon Smith is the only person who can leave a football pitch with the exact same hairdo that he's...
And that's
why it never moved.
Testament of a great player, you know, being in the right place at the right time to not have to have your hair out of place. But and you know what? Gordon was one of the very intelligent, not really football-like in the way that he approached life and the way that he was, you know, always immaculate.
Not really one of the lads, you mean? As in,
He was one. He was on the unofficial committee. Don't worry about that.
I do love these diplomatic phrases you have from the yeah. Resort to Plan B against Vince.
Okay, well, I mean, you've alluded to it already and at the beginning of the show and later on, but you did have a very, very special relationship with Alan Mullery, didn't you?
Well, I did because, you know, to be honest with you, from the first day I came in, he wanted to sign me on the first day that I come in, and he said, look, it wouldn't be fair to the club, so I'm going to give you a month. And I think they went to Israel on tour that time, and so I played in the reserves with George Aitken. And you know, when I came back, George has given him some good reports, and I got signed. But Alan was a strong man, very disappointed that he left when he did, because he had put me in the team. And then when Mike Bailey came, he didn't really fancy me, so he brought Don Shanks in, and then I got injured. I mean, I had seven knee operations, so you know, I was I had a lot of physical problems when I was there. And that's what happens in football. You know, one manager likes you and another manager doesn't like you, you know.
I mean, you didn't kick a ball under Mike Bailey.
No. And it's funny because within a day of him leaving, I was back in the team. So.
Yeah.
So, obviously that was under Jimmy Melia. I mean, Jimmy came in under Mike Bailey, didn't he? So, I mean, and it was back a game against Norwich was when you first got back in the team.
Yeah,
we won that one 3-0 as well, actually.
So yeah.
Could have come back in the team more often.
So, with the nature of the injury that you had, was it the same recurring one?
I'd had a couple of injuries when I was at Bristol, and it never really left me. So when I was at Brighton, I was always plagued by injury all the time. So I probably would have played more games had I not had those injuries, and probably played earlier. But, you know, that's what happens. And, you know, and the treatment then, I would have to say, is not the same as the treatment now.
I was just going to say, was it the kind of injury which in those days would have kept you out for X weeks, but nowadays is only going to keep you out for X days because of the way that, you know, surgery and technology have moved on? I mean, that's a bit frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, it is what it is. I mean, we had a great physio, Mike Yaxley, who was good, and he obviously administered what he could at the time. But it was in the days of cortisone, you know, where you had cortisone for a headache, you know.
Yeah, hurt me knee, cortisone.
To be honest, Al, back then, I mean, if you broke your leg, they put an ice cold sponge down your shorts. Still, I mean,
keep going, mate. Yeah.
the magic sponge got, you know, used to be overused in those days. You know, remember that.
That deep heat, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's fast forward on to that particular season. It was a relegation season, but I think that probably there was... Actually, you tell us about... I mean, we have an idea as to what it was like as watching from as fans. I was on the north stand without a roof. And we felt that we could see what we could see, that effectively the first division seemed to be being abandoned for the fact we were on this magic FA Cup run. Now, obviously, you as professionals didn't see it that way, but tell us about that season, because, I mean, it's kind of, you know, glory and failure in one hit, isn't it?
Well, I mean, we were playing quite well, but we just, you know what it's like when you're near the bottom, you know, you have a shot, it hits the outside of the post rather than the inside, and vice versa. Mm. So, you know, we weren't getting slaughtered. it was just, we were just on a bad run and we couldn't get our heads above water at that time, you know. And it was almost like the FA Cup was a bit of respite where people could relax a little bit more, because obviously you're in, expectations are not great. But, you know, after we beat Liverpool and Man City and it's almost like, well, that's coming up. Everybody was ready for it. The thing was, though, in those days, I think the FA Cup was taken a lot more seriously than it is now. Mm-hmm. The occasion of the FA Cup, you know, engulfed the country back in those days.
Yeah.
Whereas at the moment, it's just another cup. People don't look at it in the same way.
No, I agree. I mean, can I just also point out to our listener, Dave, that beating Manchester City in those days wasn't quite the achievement it would be nowadays, because actually that particular season, Man City got relegated with us. So, and I still have the scar from that day. Jimmy Kay scored twice. I still have the scar across my nose. Do you remember the fences, you know, the supposed safety fences?
The type
of fences that killed 97 people at Hillsborough. Do you remember those? That must have been a bit weird, playing effectively in front of cages.
Yeah, I mean, it's what you knew, though. At the end of the day, it's what you knew, you know. Yeah. I mean, although, rightly so, grounds have changed, but the atmosphere at some of those grounds were unbelievable. Like, you know, Roker Park was, you know, one that comes to mind, you know, in the year we stayed up when Gary Williams scored that fantastic goal near the end. And some of the other grounds, you know, some of the atmospheres and how many people could fit in was, you know, phenomenal.
Absolutely. Well, that's the nature of terracing. But I think we'll touch on, you know, the first part of the social aspect of it. I do want to talk about with you is that, you know, back in the 1970s and 80s and at that time, society was, you know, much further back than it was. It seemed to be at the time further back than where we are now, and racism was very much to the fore. You know, black people were kind of a little bit of a novelty. Not that many teams had a black player in them, and I think possibly the likes of yourself coming along, if there was any racism on the terraces at the Goldstone, it kind of stopped when you realised, hang on, we've got our own black player here. But that doesn't necessarily help you, does it? I mean, as an individual, and maybe even the only black person on the pitch out of 22 in front of 15, 20,000 people, is that a lonely place out there?
Yeah, I think it is a lonely place. But I mean, obviously, there was a fight and a resilience that you have to have if you want to get further in your career. And like you said, it was just normal. It was normal for racism to exist. So a lot of the times you experience racism, you know, you have to let it wash over your head. You had to, you don't have to, but you had to in those days, otherwise you'd be fighting every day. That's how bad it was. I would have to say that the fact that it was normalized meant that sometimes you can't even remember it because it was so normalized.
You know, I was going to say, what was the club's attitude towards you in terms of support? I mean, it'll be obviously totally different today, but what was it back then, given how society operated?
Towards me at the football club?
Yes.
At Brighton?
Yeah, how did they support you?
There was no cause to, because you wouldn't bring it up, really, because it was normal. Now, I would have to say, though, in one incident, Adam Mullery, when I got sent off, one of my yellow cards, it was in a reserve game. I won't tell you the club. It was in a reserve game. And there was some, you know, people used to go to watch reserve games in those days.
Yeah.
And I was getting abuse, and I made a gesture to the crowd, and I got booked. And Alan pulled me rather aggressively, but in a fatherly way, and said to me, you know, look, these people don't want you to succeed. And if you let them win, you won't go any further. So he gave me, you know, it was a bit more of a pep talk than that, but it really did help me at the time. And he was probably one of the first people in football that would have helped me in that manner.
Yeah. Is that the kind of thing that you'd say to a young black player now, though? I mean, surely that, you know, the given how societies you'd like to think has moved on, if you were Alan Mullery, would you say the same thing?
Well, the thing is, you've got to think about the time. At the time, there was no outcry in the same way that there is now. There right. was no, there was no global awareness that this was such a deep, undesirable situation. So someone like that, that's the kind of thing I would, at the time, would have probably been unprecedented, because most people would just have ignored it, and they would have probably had a go at you for getting the yellow card.
But I mean, Chrissy, you said it yourself, you're fighting it on the terraces, but you're also fighting it in the dressing room, because it was normalised language. Right? I mean, we're not going to go exactly. into the details of that, but I mean, it was like, what is banter and what isn't? It's just ridiculous, really, now.
Yeah, I mean, it was normalised language. It was normalised discussion amongst everybody, really, you know. And listen, it's like anything. It's like sexism. Everybody, we've all been sexist. We've all, you know, no one can say that they haven't been. Everybody, lots of people would probably look back in how they spoke to people in the past and actually be cringing. You know, you hope that the education that's been about has affected people in a positive manner, so people actually realise what they were saying was offensive and hurtful at the time. But as a black player, and being as a black player, a black person in most situations that I'm in, there's things sometimes you don't have to hear, because you'll be fighting every day, and the attitudes towards you, you can always tell. People don't always have to say. Sometimes it's the way they act towards you that's probably worse. I'd rather someone say than some of the actions that happen where they try to hide behind it.
Sure.
I mean, I know that we're going to touch on this a little bit later on as well, but I mean, there was your disciplinary record at the Albion was interesting. It was one that Adam Virgo would be proud of. I mean, there was five dismissals. Now, there was a lot of that was might have been tackled. I mean, how much was that? Because I mean, you mentioned what Alan was saying to you earlier, and you got stuff that you got booked for. I mean, was there stuff that's being said on the pitch and the red mist rose?
I had a lot of fights because of that. Throughout my career, I can't ever say that I really ever controlled it, because I didn't. You know, controlled it enough to stay in the game, but I had fights. I've had fights in my career in training, not at Albion, but I've had fights with people who have said things. Obviously, as you get older, you realise that you can't. You know, it's the only time that I'm Rocky Balboa is on the pitch.
To be honest, I can. Obviously, I can't put myself in your boots, but, you know, as someone who, yeah, have we been racist? Have we been sexist? Have we been homophobic? Have we been any of these things that are discriminatory? And somewhere down the line, of course, probably the vast majority of us have been. But I think nowadays, as someone who's 52 and a bit smelly and a bit old, I do get triggered when I hear racist comments. And so as someone who has been the target of them, I can, you know, the red mist is actually fully understandable. And whilst we sort of tease you about your five red cards in 37 games or whatever it might be, you know, it's also comes across as indicative of, and I know you've actually touched on the subject, of what appears to be a lack of support. Because I would imagine that you probably wanted to go through your career a little less angry.
Yeah. You would. But like I said, in those days, I mean, I think a lot of black players would have kept the lid on it in order to push on in their career, because it happens so much, you'd be complaining every day. Mm. So, you know, so at that stage, was anybody going to do anything about it in those days? No, they weren't going to do anything about it in those days. So therefore, one, you get seen as a troublemaker, and also you're forcing people to do something that they don't want to do is number two subject with it, you know. So you know, we can look back and say, well, was there any support? The whole of football didn't support black players in those days. So it's not just down to one club. was down to the whole football to actually be aware much earlier than they were.
Okay, well, we're going to come back to that in a minute, but first, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. As ever, this show is brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. Normally, we have a guess about what the shirt this is, but I mean, Chris, I know that you know what it is, so you might as well just put us all out of our misery.
Swindon Town, that would have been probably, I don't know, 1986, I think.
Not quite. 80, not 80, quite.
What would it have been, an 85? No.
84, 85.
84, 85. Oh, yeah, that was when I went on loan there.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Can you describe the shirt for us?
It's a red shirt, crimson with white stripes. About six white stripes across the front.
Pinstripes, yeah.
And pinstripes, yeah. Yeah.
Can I also just say that they could...
Spall.
They could also do with a proper graphic designer, because the badge just says ST.
They have been
besmirched by some pretty appalling badge designs in their past.
I think they ran out of letters in the
they
shop.
They did. We've got more roundabouts than letters.
This is what Chris has to say. Sorry, this is what Chris has to say. This is what Phil has to say about this particular shirt and your shirt of the week. And it's a perfect example of a superb lower league shirt from the 80s. This is the 1984-85 home shirt of the Robins, also known as Swindon Town. But I'm sure your guest has already guessed that already. Yes, he has. As worn by Chris Ramsey after his move from the Albion, this shirt was worn in Division 4 and the Division 4 campaign when Swindon finished 8th in the league. A remarkable climb followed that, with the Robins winning the Division 4 title in 85-86, and then the following year gaining promotion to Division 2 via the playoffs. The playoff final was against Gillingham, initially played over two legs, home and away, which resulted in a 2-2 aggregate scoreline. A replay was required, which was played at Selhurst Park, which Swindon won 2-0 in front of a crowd of 18,000. Swindon were formed in 1879 and moved into the county ground in 1896, where they have remained to this present day. The current capacity of the stadium is 15,728, but the highest recorded attendance is 32,000 for the visit of Arsenal in the third round of the FA Cup in 1972. Swindon used to play in white shirts and black shorts. For away games, there was a clash and they wore a blue sash over the top. During early years, they wore black and red quarters, green with white sleeves, and all green shirts until 1918, when they settled on red as their home colours. Like most teams, Swindon Town has teams regards as rivals, and for some reason, they seem to hate more teams than most. The list of their rivals includes Oxford, Reading, Bristol City, Bristol Rovers, Cheltenham, Newport, and Forest Green. There are a few links to the Albion. Chris Ramsey played 100 games between 1984 and 1987 after leaving the Albion in 84. Gordon Greer joined the Albion from Swindon in 2010, making over 70 appearances for the Robins. Midfielder Yasser Kassin joined the Albion in 2010, but had limited playing time and moved on to the Robins. There's a load of that, actually. There's Trevor Benjamin, Calvin Andrews, Stephen Alzatti was on loan there for a bit. Wayne Gray, Rowan Ince, Junior Lewis, Craig Mastell. There's millions of them. Anyway, thanks for that. And of course, you can see this shirt and many, many more. Over 120,000 of them over in oldfootballshirts.com, including the current shirt worn by QPR, which is made by Araya, which of course made loads of the Albion kids.
Phil's favourite maker. I think you struggled to get him away from that. Yeah. But actually, let's talk about the times where the Albion wore a kit made by Adidas. We've talked about the season, but let's talk about the cup run, Chris. That's what, frankly, the main reason we asked you on for, because that's what you're mostly remembered for. You know, at least you're a Brighton fan that's remembered for something. And let's face it. Surely every footballer wants to be remembered for something.
Because nobody remembers the 5 red cards.
No. And the ball's clipped into the stands when they're supposed to go to the forward.
You weren't alone in that, to be honest.
So tell us about your memories of the cup run.
Oh, the cup run was phenomenal. It was something, a boy's dream. In those days, you didn't even think about winning the league. You thought more about scoring in the last minute of the FA Cup. And it was something that was very surreal for me at the time.
Yeah, I mean, there was the game we used to play in the playground as kids.
Yeah,
I'm not sure that Wembley. Played there, but it was Wembley, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
We all used to want to play at Wembley.
Exactly.
And of course, you did that. You did get to do that. I mean, the run there as well, obviously starting that game at home to Newcastle, which was a draw, going up to St. James's for the replay. A certain Peter Ward brought back a few memories. I mean, it must have been great for you to play with Wardy.
Yeah, no, listen, Wardy was a phenomenal goal scorer. I mean, unfortunately, the game here lost him to America. You know, but he was phenomenal, and he played for the great Brian Clough as well. So that was he had some great stories about him as well, you know.
Yeah, we've heard a few.
Oh God, yes. Oh God, yes. I was about to say the fella dines out on him, but you know, he is your ultimate short arms, long pockets fella. But back to the 83 Cup run. Sorry to say, you didn't get to score in any of them, but to be part of something, I mean, could. If I remember this as a 14-year-old, no, tell a lie, 13-year-old, there was something magic about it. When we got to the Cup semi-final a couple of years ago, it didn't feel quite the same. When we got to the Cup quarter-final about 3 years later, it didn't feel quite the same. But there was something magic about this particular Cup run, probably the quality of the sides that we were getting past. Was there any sort of real buzz about the club for it as well?
The buzz was phenomenal. I mean, it was... the whole city was behind us, you know, and every time we got to the next round, I mean, when we beat Liverpool at Anfield, you know, we were one of the first teams that continually flew to games because we were sponsored by British Caledonian.
Yeah.
And obviously Brighton being where it is, every trip is a long trip, even if it's in London.
Yeah.
You know, every trip is a long trip. So we flew to a lot of games up north and when we got back from there, you know, it was almost like we'd won the whole thing, you know. But it was brilliant.
Yeah. So let's fast forward to the 21st of May, 1983. Were you the first choice right back at that time, or was it the case that it was going to be a bit sort of up in the air as to whether you were going to get your place on the day?
No, I was the first choice because I. Lo and behold, I'd been sent off and I missed the semi-final. what happened was I came, fortunate for me, Jimmy liked me as a player and I was pretty confident that I was going to get my place back. And I played actually in the reserves on the Monday just to get some game minutes against Oxford. And the first tackle I did, I flew into someone and they nearly took me off because they thought I was going to get sent off. and missed the game, but I was really lucky because obviously Steve Foster missed the final, and that meant that we had to rejiggle. So that made it even more sure that I'd play because Gary Stevens had to play as centre back.
Sure.
Okay. Well, let's go through like some FA Cup trivia then, because I mean we love it was the only game that was on the telly for a start.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and there was a lot of pomp and ceremony. There was like recording a single. There was getting measured for your suits. So talk us through both of those, because A, the suits were rubbish.
They were poor. What about the shoes? Shoes were white. Poor.
I was doing.
This is 1983, though, Chris. To be fair,
cream shoes and cream suits and black trousers. I mean, whose idea was that?
Jimmy Villa.
He's a lot to answer for.
He's got a lot to answer for, but we did go on Top of the Pops, so we've done that as well.
Talkers going. You went into the recording studio, did Boys in Hell, Bright and Blue, back with the Goldstone Rap.
Yeah, so, we did that.
And what was it like going to the studio? And who were the singers and who didn't? Who were the mimers?
Well, all I can say is that my mic got turned off pretty early after the first chorus.
there was a hidden track as well, wasn't there? We spoke to Gordon Smith about this, and he actually recorded another song where he was singing on his own. What can you remember about that?
I don't know. He probably got some royalties for that. I might have to think. I might have had a little co-op somewhere in that.
No, I think he quite fancied himself as a musician. We've got the story of him playing Paul McCartney's piano or something like that. That's not folklore, but yeah, that's the kind of tart he is. But yeah, I mean, the whole thing, the whole build-up, you know, you had, because it was not just on television, it was on ITV and BBC.
Exactly, it was.
And Radio 2, Peter Jones and Smith Must Score,
So
on and so forth. So it was the big thing. I mean, yeah, I take your point, it's not the same now. So, I mean, I would imagine that for someone like yourself, it's, you know, there's players who've played in several FA Cup finals. You've played in one, but it's going to be with you to the day you die, isn't it?
Of course it is, because my mum, it was she saw that. She's not with us anymore. And, you know, it's more for your family, really, than anything else, you know. Your family and everybody around you, you know, willing you to do well. And plus, everybody that you know will be watching, because, like you said, it was the only game on, the only thing on the TV at 3 o'clock that day on both channels. We only had three channels in those days, so we wanted to watch TV. Two of them had the game on, you know, and it was on in the evening as well. So it was absolutely phenomenal, the coverage that it was. And this one of the things, when you look back, you had the FA Cup final, you had the Grand National, you had the Royal Variety Show. These are things that everybody zoomed into at the time.
Absolutely.
And it was national institutions at the time.
Absolutely. Now, the game itself, you had this 17-year-old upstart pretty much in your pocket, didn't you?
Well, I did all right.
I'm going to put this out there. Now, maybe you felt differently because you're on the pitch, but I remember watching the game. You had to mark Norman White's side on pretty much on the left-hand side. You were playing right back. And, you know, this was a kid who was seen as the next great big thing, you know, especially, you know, 17-year-old, the next George Best, you know, who's a Northern Ireland kiddie from Manchester United, already played in the World Cup, et cetera, et cetera. And you had the job of marking. I mean, in comparative terms, as a 21-year-old, you were a veteran. But, but you know, for the game itself, you know, you kept him quiet. And I'm going to say this as a Brighton fan. Now, I do appreciate that you, as a football player, as a professional, might feel different. But I'm not sure that I ever could. Have you forgiven Whiteside for actually putting you out of the game? Because I'm still angry about it 38 years on.
Well, to be honest with you, we both were known for putting our foot in. We were both known for that. And I had received, believe it or not, a lot of hate mail before the cup final about not getting sent off. And I received a few racist letters before that. And I'm not saying that's the reason why I got done, but I purposely decided not to be a ruffian on that day.
Right.
And I went in, and he did what I would have done to him had I tackled in the way that I normally used to tackle.
Yeah.
So that was the case. You know, he probably thought I was going to do him, so he done me first.
Really? Because I mean, it was certainly a tackle which nowadays would be straight red. I mean, you know, the lack of leniency that you have in referees nowadays.
Yeah.
I think probably for the better. For the most part, but that was it was a wild lunge, and it left you crocked a little bit. And you know, United got their equal. I'm going to put such a bold statement out there and say that if Whiteside hadn't done that, and that you two were still on the pitch at the end of 90 minutes, Brighton would have won the FA Cup, because you basically nullified him. You might feel different, but from an observer, albeit a biased observer, you nullified one of their main threats. And I still say that Brighton would have won the cup if he hadn't done that.
Well, the thing is, I didn't get back to the far post to clear the ball.
You couldn't.
Because I was hobbling.
Yeah.
So, you know, hopefully my granddaughter now, that's what she's going to hear in a couple of years' time.
But the point is, no one blames you because you have been smashed.
Yeah.
You know, and Jerry Ryan came on, obviously did the job that Jerry Ryan does.
Well, yeah, but it's only one side, you know, though, wasn't there as well? Because, you know, now you would have brought out, you like Chris got stretchered off, you'd have brought on another defender. So well, now there was Jerry Ryan, Jerry Ryan, or Jerry Ryan.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So tell us, I mean, he got, you know, sort of done over. So tell us about Jerry Ryan.
Jerry Ryan, Jerry was one of these players, he was a talisman. You never knew what he was going to do, but he always did something good.
Yeah.
You know, his dribbling was unbelievable. And do you know what? He's always popped up with the odd goal when you didn't expect it. You know, and he, what a nice man as well. You know, he's one of the nicest people we were ever going to meet, you know, Jerry.
Sure. So let's move on to, obviously, you know, your game was up, well, probably about 60 minutes in, wasn't it? Something like that?
I think so. Yeah, I think so.
65 minutes in, I lose track. And then that was largely it for the rest of the season. And you know, for any Brighton fan, the less said about the replay, the better. But
there was a replay.
I have to ask you this. Where were you on 120 minutes with the last kick of the game? Were you actually still watching?
I was sat on the bench.
Yeah.
I was sat on the bench and, you know, just thinking about, was I going to make it for Thursday, you know? And
yeah.
it was terrible because you're hoping you're going to make it, but you probably know you're not going to make it because it was like a broken ankle.
Right.
With ligament damage. But you're trying your best. You know, you're doing anything you can do. You're having your obligatory quarters in your ankle. But it wasn't to me.
Now, 38 years on, Gordon Smith is still apologising. Did he apologise to you lot in the dressing room at the time?
There was no need to.
No, we know that, but he still is.
Yeah, but there was no need to. You know, I mean, people miss worse than that. You know, but...
Well,
but,
you know. Gordon's putting it down to a brilliant save rather than a bad miss.
But he's still apologising. So as an Albion player, doing something so unique, and I'm not talking about just obviously the thing that was mentioned in Black History Month last week of being the first black player to play in a major cup final for the Albion. What I mean is that being part of history, of being part of the cup final side, obviously we lost the replay quite badly. What did it mean to you as a professional to play in the FA Cup final at such a time when the FA Cup final meant so much more than it does now?
It's obviously one of the biggest things in your life. It's a life achievement in comparison to, you know, how it's been trivialized at the, you know, now. But it was a life achievement at the time. And the problem is, you know, they say youth is wasted on the young, but it actually is in that situation because I wouldn't say you take it for granted, but everybody says to you, look, enjoy it because it will be, you know, it'll go past very quickly. And you never know when you're going to be there again. And never a truer word was said.
Yeah.
You know, you enjoy it, but you can't really take it in. And then before you know it, you try, but it's a distant memory now. Because although you start looking back and you do start remembering things, but, you know, you probably would savour it a little bit more if you probably weren't so young and weren't in a situation where it's come to you quite quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact is for me, you know, if you think about it, 2 years earlier, I'd been released. Two and a bit years earlier, I'd been released from Bristol City. And then, you know, within the third season of being released, I'm standing, you know, at Wembley shaking the hand of royalty.
You're now a member of the British Empire yourself.
And I'm very proud to be that as well.
I'm just going to quickly tell that stat that AD hates me telling. You realise that the FA Cup final was closer to the end of the Second World War than it was to today.
Oh, thanks.
Oh, sorry, I've just made Chris really facepalm big time.
Oh, hey.
Big time. Now, obviously, you went on to have your career at Swindon, and sorry, with all due respect, this is an Albion podcast, so we're going to just sort of focus on this. But moving on to your time when you finished your playing career, and we've got to sort of wrap it up soon in the next 5 minutes or so because we're running out of time, is that as an England coach, and as AD said at the top of the show, the first black person to actually get a role in that particular, first male to get a role at the FA, and your work with trying to promote diversity and inclusivity, for which, as AD just said, you've now received an MBE. Tell us about the work that you've been doing, both as a football coach and as a diversity officer.
Well, it really started heavily with your own Hope Powell. because me and myself and Hope worked for the FA at the same time. We started, I think, 1997, 1998. And then through there, through the time I've been working in football, it's very important. I think it's very important to use your platform to make people aware of inequalities, regardless of what they are. So throughout the time I've been in the game, and every time I do get an opportunity to outline some inequality, I tend to do that. I tend to try to do that. And any time there's a purpose to be supported, I'm always there or trying to be there to make sure that people do understand that there is a lot of inequality, not only in the football world, but in the world in general.
And how do you go about trying to achieve that?
Well, I think that you have to realise that you're in a privileged position, and any time that you can promote it, whether it could be, for argument's sake, we have a lot of minorities working at the football club. We have we're very aware of the gender, lack of the gender mix in the club, so we do employ female coaches, but not in a token capacity. We make sure that you know, anybody who's good enough is not held back by you know, either being a minority or being a female or being disabled. We had a deaf coach last year who worked here, you know, so we try to be very inclusive, but we do make sure that whatever we do, it isn't looked upon as a token thing, because there is a lot of people out there who are talented but are in the minority, and they never get a voice and never get an opportunity to be helped.
You had a spell in the dugout yourself at QPR as well. You were on the bench, you do a coach at Spurs as well. You know, I mean, there's a lot of talk about the lack of diversity in the dugouts up and down the country. I mean, how do you feel that's changing now?
No, I don't think it's changing. I think the problems are still the same. I think the awareness is out there, but you know, it's obviously the decision makers. There needs to be more diversity on boards. And diversity in thought, not just diversity in colour or gender, but diversity in thought, which I would imagine should help there to be more diversity in the game in general. I think sometimes we talk about evolution all the time, and I think that doesn't work. I think more revolutionary processes need to come into place in order to get things changed. If you think about it, we're talking about the cup final 38 years ago, and I was probably the only black player on the pitch. There was probably no black coaches in any of the leagues at that time. And even though things have moved forward, we still have 92 teams, remember, and the percentages are still very, very low. So
with that in mind, going forward, with work you yourself and so many others are doing, how does that sea of change come about? I mean, you've talked about the decision makers, but is it just them and them alone, or is there, let's say, an entire sort of clear out required?
Well, there's never going to be a clear out, because people own clubs, and people are on boards. Boards are not going to vote themselves out. As we know, there's always succession planning. If the succession planning doesn't allow there to be more diversity on the boards, then they'll stay the same. Now, how we change it is going to be down to people wanting to change it. And unfortunately, you know, the gatekeepers have got to understand that if they want to be seen as people that are diverse in their thought and in their actions, that they have to make a radical change. Then evolutionary change doesn't help, because it takes too long, and before you know it, your career's over. So for argument's sake, we have a lot of the federations, they put things in place that are 5 years. 5 years, we'll review it in 5 years. In 5 years, if you're in your 40s, that's a chunk of your career gone. And if you review it and it doesn't work, then you put another 5-year thing into place. That's 10 years. I've been very, very fortunate, I must admit. In general, this is my 43rd season, I think, in the game. You know, I probably missed one when I was injured and I was out of the game. But for 43 years, I've been in the game in some capacity. So sticking your head above the parapet is important, because it's easy for me to just stay here, stay under the radar, you know, get my salary and just plod on till I get to my mid-60s and leave the game. But I do believe when you have a platform, it's very, very important to realise, one, your fortune, and two, that there are people that went before me that opened doors that allowed me to come through. And this is not just about Black people that have opened doors. You know, without the collaboration of cultures, there is no door opening. One culture can't open the door. Everybody has to be involved at some stage. There has to be people that help other people to open the door. So I'm not just saying it's only Black people or only Asian people that have opened the doors. There've been a lot of good white people that have seen the error of what's gone on before and have joined in the fight. So that's the way I look at it.
And before we leave it there, we just have to ask the question, Chris, what does Brighton Hove Albion mean to you?
It's something that helped put me on the map. And it's in a place that's close to my heart always. And I've got some memories there that will never leave me.
Well, don't forget where your friends are, mate.
You know, the real tragedy about this now is that I could actually carry on and listen to you for hours, though, Chris. And this is, you know, No, this is wonderful. Listen, thank you so much for coming on our show. I can a belated congratulations on your gong. It was very, very well earned. And
thank you very much.
And naturally, all the things that you're trying to do there, you have our full support. So when we talk about sort of, you know, wanting to have you on for Black History Month, no, forget the month. That's an anathema. It should be a Black History Life. People should actually know about this all the time and not just be so tokenistic as to have it of a month. Chris, good luck with everything, mate. It's so good to have had you on the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks, sir. It's been an honour. It's been an honour.
No, it's been an honour for us, mate. Thank you.
Thank you.
So thank you, of course, to Chris Ramsey. Thank you to Alan Wares. I've been AD Packham. This has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.9 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and, of course, on our podcast. We'll be back with you again next week. Thanks for listening. See you then. Bye.